In his veto message to Secretary of State Natalie Tennant, Tomlin wrote, quote, "I hereby disapprove and return enrolled House Bill 4588. I am advised the bill is unconstitutional under controlling precedent of the Supreme Court of the United States." End quote. The federal Supreme Court has already overturned an Arizona bill containing a very similar post-20-week ban, as well as written other decisions disapproving the practice of limiting a woman's ability to get an abortion before what's considered the stage of viability, or 24 weeks. With that, the West Virginia bill was shot down, even after passing both chambers by an overwhelming majority. The House supported the measure on a vote of 83-15, and in the Senate, 29-5. Since the disapproval, Democrats and Republicans alike have expressed concern over the decision, going as far as calling for a special session to override the veto. But that's where the constitutional question has evolved. Under our current system, can the legislature override a veto after the regular session has adjourned? House Minority Leader Tim Armstead says he thinks the answer is obvious.
I believe the Constitution, while it's silent and it could be more clear on that issue, I believe the Constitution allows us to go back into session and override a veto.
But other members of the House are not so sure. House attorneys are currently researching their options, as confirmed by General Counsel for the Chamber Joe Altizer, but declined to release any specifics on what exactly they're looking into or who has ordered the research. A Supreme Court decision from 1909, however, indicates that the minority leader's assumption may be correct. In May versus Topping, Maud May's husband, Attorney General Clark May, passed away after his annual salary was approved by the legislature, but before the governor vetoed it. May was asking the court, as the executor of her husband's estate, to order then House Clerk C.L. Topping to pay her that $2,000-some salary as the legislature had approved. The court ultimately ruled in May's favor, saying while the governor did have 5 days to enroll his objections to the appropriation, he did so after the legislature had adjourned, preventing him from returning the bill to its originating chamber for reconsideration and a possible override. In a larger sense, the court decision says the ultimate veto power is reserved for the people who are represented by their legislators. The court summed up any future doubt in who may hold the ultimate power by saying, quote, "Thus we see that the legislative, not the executive will, has been made supreme. Is it not the legislative will in whose favor such doubt should be resolved?" End quote. The court was saying, should there be doubt in who has the final say over a proposed law, the doubt should be resolved by assuming the legislature has the ultimate power. The decision, however, was written before language was added in the 1970s. The current Constitution gives the governor 15 days after adjournment to register his veto with the Secretary of State's office instead of the 5 days allotted when the 1909 ruling was written. Still, the decision seems to support Armstead's position that the legislature has the ultimate say, and not the stance of the governor's office that the vetoed bill is dead and cannot be reconsidered. But Armstead says it comes back to decades of the legislature deferring its power to the office of governor.
I think it's important from a legislative standpoint that we do our job and we don't cede any of that role to the courts or to the governor. I think it's important that the governor do his job and not cede those powers to the legislature or the courts. Not because it's a power issue or anything. It's just because it's how it works. And I think what we're seeing to some degree is, have been seeing over the years, is it's more of a political deference.
Armstead and other House Republicans have called on Attorney General Patrick Morrissey for an official, modern opinion on the issue. In a letter dated April 9th addressed to legislative leaders, Morrissey concluded the legislature could override a veto in a legislatively initiated special session. That means a session called after 3/5 of the members of each chamber petition the governor. He goes on to say there is no clear statement in the Constitution that restricts the override authority, which the Supreme Court in a 1980 decision said must be present. Morrissey ends the letter, however, by saying, quote, "We have found no court case deciding the authority of a legislature-initiated special session to override such a veto, nor have we located any examples of such a special session attempting to override such a veto." end quote. He writes, lawmakers should caution testing such power when it takes only a simple majority to override the governor's veto. Morrissey suggests instead, lawmakers could call themselves into session, pass another bill essentially with the same language, recess to await the inevitable second veto, and override it with the same simple majority vote it took to pass the bill. Governor Tomlin is already calling for a special session during May interims to address overtime issues with a recently approved bill to increase the state minimum wage. But, as per his constitutional powers, since he is calling the special session, he also retains the right to set the agenda. However, as Morrissey states, should the legislature call themselves back into session with a petition of 3/5 of the members of each chamber, they reserve the right to set the agenda. And his stance is backed by an opinion written in 1954 by then Attorney General John Fox. In that opinion, Fox writes, when the legislature petitions themselves into session, they should be considered to be in a plenary or open session and can, quote, act on any subject not interdicted by the Constitution itself. However, he maintains, should the governor call that session, lawmakers are bound to the governor's agenda, with some flexibility in its interpretation. That means for the May session, legislatures could not take up the abortion bill unless the governor decides to put it in the call, which is unlikely. Instead, if a decision is made to attempt an override or vote on a new bill, as Morrissey suggests, lawmakers must petition the governor themselves. While it's difficult to find all of the cases in which lawmakers have called their own sessions, the documents studied for this story indicated only two: a special session called in the 1860s under Governor Arthur Borman and in the 1980s under Governor Jay Rockefeller. As research into the constitutional powers continues at the legislature, the question arises, are we seeing an increased concentration on the balance of power because of a narrowing gap between the parties? Armstead says, it's possible.
So I think that's one thing that I'd like to see the legislature come back into its role a little more. And that's not a criticism necessarily of the legislature, but it's a criticism of what has happened, I think, over the last few decades, where we've become so deferential to the governor that we've never...
However, former Governor Bob Wise, who served terms in the state Senate and U.S. House before his tenure as governor, says it's not political, it's structural.
My observation is that there is a natural tension between the governor, the legislature, and the Supreme Court. And even when one party might have a great clear dominance in the Senate and the House, you still had different factions within that party that were always pressing to either limit the governor's power or to somehow alter the balance of power. So this is, to me, not necessarily partisan. It's just a natural tension that exists between the legislative branches. This is a natural process regardless of what party's in control.
A natural tension between two branches that often appear to be at odds. It remains to be seen, however, if a battle over abortions will sway the current balance of power.